Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This movie afforded me the opportunity to go back to my more recent lineage, 100 years or so, and go back to, the Mississippi, a state that I had never been to.
We speak to the celebrated Hollywood director Ryan Coogler about his new film, Sinners, a horror film about two brothers fighting an evil force in Jim Crow, Mississippi.
I ain't ever seen no demons, no ghosts, no magic, till now.
Then to a real story in Memphis, Tennessee, about two brothers fighting Elon Musk, the richest man in the world.
XAI, Elon Musk's company, is operating 35 gas turbines in southwest Memphis, in the neighborhood where myself and my entire family lives. This is horrific news.
So we found an Electrolux factory in Memphis. That's why it's in Memphis. Home of Elvis.
How is it good for Memphis if it continues to pollute our air? How is it good for Memphis when the community is locked out?
We'll go to Memphis to speak with brothers Keyshawn Pearson and Tennessee State Representative Justin Pearson. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Gaza. Israeli attacks have killed more than 60 people since early Thursday, bringing the death toll since Israel shattered a ceasefire agreement last month to nearly 2,000. Among the recent dead are a family of five, a pregnant mother, a father, and their three children, who were killed by an Israeli drone strike on their tent in the southern Gaza Strip. Another strike early Thursday collapsed a home in Gaza City, killing a Palestinian former prisoner and his entire family.
Our neighbor was imprisoned for 13 years, and after he was released, he got married and had children. His eldest daughter is 8 years old, and his youngest son is a year and a half old. He was born during the war. Ali al-Sarafiti's entire family died and was erased from the civil registry, along with his siblings and himself. They all died.
Israel's military on Thursday offered a rare apology to the United Nations after an Israeli tank shelled a guest house in Gaza last month, killing a UN staff member and wounding six others. Israel initially denied responsibility. Israeli attacks have killed at least 285 UN workers since October 2023. President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, has arrived in Moscow for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. His visit comes a day after President Trump called out Putin in a rare rebuke after a major Russian airstrike on Kyiv killed 12 people and injured dozens of others. Posting on social media, Trump wrote, quote, "Vladimir, stop." The word stop in all caps, adding, quote, "Let's get the peace deal done." But later on Thursday, Trump insisted Putin has made great progress towards establishing peace with Ukraine.
What concessions has Russia offered up thus far to get to the point where you're closer to peace?
Stopping the war, stopping taking the whole country. Pretty big concession.
Overnight, a Russian drone strike on an apartment building in the southeastern city of Pavlorod killed three civilians and injured 14 others. Meanwhile, Russian media is reporting a senior Russian military officer was killed this morning in a car bomb attack outside Moscow. The Trump administration is poised to offer Saudi Arabia a weapons deal worth well over $100 billion. That's according to Reuters, which reports President Trump will announce the deal during a trip to Saudi Arabia next month, the first country he'll visit during his second term in office. In 2017, Trump made a similar trip to Riyadh as the first overseas visit of his first term. That same year, he proposed a $110 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia. Indian and Pakistani forces have exchanged cross-border fire as tensions mount between the nuclear-armed nations following Tuesday's shooting attack in Indian-administered Kashmir that killed 26 people. On Thursday, Pakistan closed its airspace to India and threatened to halt all bilateral agreements with India. A group called the Resistance Front has claimed responsibility for the massacre. Islamabad has rejected India's claims the attack was supported by Pakistan. On Thursday, Kashmiris took to the streets to call for an end to the violence.
We strongly condemn this terrible act that has been done day before yesterday. And we just want to say that terrorism doesn't have a particular religion. And we as common Kashmiris stand for peace and will always stand for peace.
A federal judge Thursday blocked part of Trump's executive order requiring documentary proof of U.S. citizenship to register to vote in federal elections. Trump's order was issued in an attempt to circumvent Congress. Earlier this month, the Republican-led House passed the measure as part of a voter suppression bill known as the SAVE Act. But Senate Democrats vowed to block the bill through a filibuster. In a statement, the ACLU said, quote, this executive order is part of a broader attack on our democratic elections by promoting baseless nativist conspiracy theories. Today, the court blocked a key strategy of this attack, they said. President Trump's calling for the Justice Department to investigate Act Blue, the online fundraising platform used by most Democratic politicians. Trump accused Act Blue of allowing fraudulent donations. Act Blue called the claims baseless. When Red, the Republican fundraising platform, has also faced reports of donor-related issues, though is not named in Trump's memo to Attorney General Pam Bondi. ActBlue's CEO Regina Wallace-Jones called Trump's probe, quote, the next version of the big lie. A federal judge in California has barred the Trump administration from denying or placing conditions on federal funds to sanctuary cities and counties that limit cooperation with federal immigration agencies. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Maryland has ordered the Trump administration to facilitate the return of a 20-year-old Venezuelan immigrant who is among the group of over 200 transferred from the United States to El Salvador in March. District Judge Stephanie Gallagher, who was appointed by Trump, said his expulsion from the U.S. violated a previous court settlement that protected him from removal while his asylum case was pending. The asylum seeker, who's been identified only as Christian, was part of a class action lawsuit filed in 2019 by a group of undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as unaccompanied children. Three federal judges on Thursday blocked Trump's plans to cut federal funding from K through 12 schools that have DEI. Diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. In one case, Judge Landia McCafferty called Trump's move, quote, textbook viewpoint discrimination, and said the Education Department, quote, does not even define what a DEI program is. In related news, President Trump signed an executive order this week targeting college accreditors, private companies that determine whether universities meet standards for federal funding. Trump accused the accreditors of supporting DEI initiatives and, quote, allowing our colleges to become dominated by Marxist maniacs, unquote. The order would enable the Trump administration to revoke approval from accreditors that factor DEI into their evaluations. Students at the City College of New York rallied on campus Thursday to demand their administration divest from Israel and prioritize student safety amidst a mounting crackdown on rights across higher education. Students established what they call the Hilmi al-Bakawi Liberated Zone, a tribute to the slain journalist who was killed when Israel struck a press tent in Khan Yunis earlier this month. Campus security and the New York Police Department moved in to suppress the peaceful protest, deploying pepper spray on the students. Congolese government forces and Rwanda-backed M23 fighters have agreed to a temporary ceasefire while they continue to negotiate a broader peace deal for the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Talks are being brokered by Qatar. The M23 has seized two major cities in eastern DRC, Goma and Bukavu, killing over 7,000 people and displacing another 1.2 million since the start of the year. Tunisian authorities on Thursday dismantled a makeshift camp in Sfax, a major transit hub for sub-Saharan African refugees. It was the second such destruction of refugee housing this month. Together, the demolished camps once housed some 7,000 people. It's part of a larger plan to expel undocumented sub-Saharan Africans from Tunisia without offering any alternatives or basic rights. This is one of the displaced migrants.
When I came, I was in the city, but there are times when I want to come here to use it as a crossing point to Europe. Each time, there's a dismantling of camps, and we have to change camps. These are the different difficulties we face here. When they come like that, they tear down all the houses and everything you have. You lose it in a blink of an eye, and those are the different difficulties that we face now.
In Guatemala, authorities arrested indigenous leader Luis Pacheco, accusing him of terrorism and what his supporters say is retaliation for leading nationwide protests in 2023 against attempts to derail President Bernardo Arevalo's transition to power. Pacheco is now serving as Arevalo's deputy energy minister. He's also the former president of the 48 Cantons, the governance authority that represents indigenous communities in the western highlands of Totonicapán. President Trump signed an executive order to expedite deep-sea mining permits, both in U.S. and international waters. That's despite relatively strict regulations on deep-sea mining established under the 1994 U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea. The U.S. is the only major coastal nation that has not ratified the treaty. Conservationists are calling for a moratorium on deep-sea mining to protect vulnerable ecosystems in one of the Earth's few remaining untouched habitats, which contain deposits of minerals like cobalt, zinc, and gold. And the mass shooter who opened fire on a 4th of July parade in 2022 in Highland Park, Illinois, received seven consecutive life sentences Thursday, one for each of the people he killed. Robert Cremo III pleaded guilty in March. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, our interview with the acclaimed filmmaker, Ryan Coogler.
I don't know why the hell I'm here. Traveling. I don't know why in the hell I'm here. Because the woman I'm loving, you know she really, she really don't care.
Travelin', Buddy Guy, a song featured on the soundtrack of the new movie Sinners. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with one of Hollywood's most celebrated filmmakers, Ryan Coogler. Although just 38 years old, Coogler has made a series of acclaimed hits, from Creed to the Marvel Black Panther films. He also co-produced the Fred Hampton biopic Judas and the Black Messiah. Born in Oakland, California, Ryan Coogler's first film was the Sundance and Cannes Award-winning Fruitvale Station from 2013 about the killing of Oscar Grant on the BART train platform. Ryan Coogler's latest film is Sinners, made with his wife Zinzi Evans, a horror film set in 1932 in the Mississippi Delta during Jim Crow. The film has two stars. They're both actor Michael B. Jordan. He plays identical twin brothers, Smoke and Stack, who've just returned to their hometown after years living in Chicago working for the gangster Al Capone. The twins purchase an old sawmill from a racist white landowner to start a juke joint for the local black community when they're confronted by a supernatural evil. Oh, and did I say it's a vampire film? This is the film's trailer.
I've been all over this world. I seen men die in ways I ain't even know was possible. Love you, brother. Be careful. I will. With all the things that I seen, I ain't ever seen no demons. No ghosts. No magic. Till now.
Hey, get back inside.
Let me in, man. Some weird going on out here.
You keep dancing with the devil. Gonna follow you home.
That's the trailer for the new critically acclaimed vampire horror film Sinners. We go now to Oakland, California, where we're joined by the film's acclaimed director, writer, Ryan Coogler. His other feature films include Fruitvale Station, Creed, the record-breaking Black Panther, its sequel, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Ryan, it's great to have you back on Democracy Now! After we talked to you in Sundance more than a decade ago. This is an astounding film.
Oh, thank you, Amy. It's good to see you as well. And I appreciate the kind words about it. We worked really hard on it. Me and my wife, Zinzi Cougar, our partner, Sevak Ohanian, and all of us at Proximity Media. This film meant everything to us. And it's been a joy to share it with the world and to have time to talk about it with people like you.
Well, talk about how you developed the idea for this and wrote it. I mean, this mm-hmm. horror film, this film about everything from Jim Crow to slavery, the magnificent music, and the fact that you made it a vampire film.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a great group of questions. You know, like, to be honest with you, my family is like many families in California. We products of the second wave of the Great Migration, meaning that, you know, before California, my family was in the South, in the Gulf states primarily, but also some of them were in Mississippi. And it's ironic because with my grandmother and her mom before her and my mom are known for is their gumbo. They cook a style of gumbo that comes from Port Arthur, Texas, and as you know, that the dish is probably most famous in Louisiana. But it's combining a lot of different elements into one uniform dish that's beloved. My family is known for making some of the best gumbo, and this was my opportunity to make some cinematic gumbo. You know, I took some things that might seem disparate, you know, in a description, but I think they go very well together. You know, I grew up in Oakland, and one of the most important people in my life was my Uncle James Edmondson, who was a Mississippi man who married my grandmother's younger sister, Sammy, who the main character in the film is named after. But for a considerable amount of time, he was the oldest male member of my family, and I just really loved spending time with him. And all he wanted to do when he was off from work was listen to blues music, drink old Taylor whiskey, and maybe catch a game of San Francisco Giants on the radio. You know, and I associated that music with him. You know, I never felt like it belonged to me. It felt like it was music for, you know, for older people. But he passed away in 2015. And I was devastated. I was away from home as I normally was, making a film called Creed. When I got the news, and after he passed, I started to listen to old blues records to kind of remind myself of him. And if I did it enough, I would feel like he was there with me, almost like I was conjuring his spirit. And the base of the idea started with that. And when I started to do my research on blues music, specifically the Delta blues music that came out of that Mississippi Delta, I discovered that, you know, there's a firm argument to be made that this art form, the Delta blues, is our country's most important contribution to global popular culture. You know, I think it's probably our most important artistic contribution to the world. And it was such a profound discovery this music made by people who were, you know, for all intents and purposes, living under a backbreaking form of American apartheid, you know, denied that humanity on a daily basis would create something so artistically excellent that it would affect, you know, global culture, you know, from that time forward. And that was what I saw to make. I saw to make something personal and true, but also epic and mythical. You know, I grew up loving horror stories in literature and in cinema. You know, so I combined that as well. You know, I had an appetite for showing more of myself, you know, after having over a decade working in franchise filmmaking, you know, if that makes sense. I was very passionate about those projects, but those projects weren't completely my own. So I was excited to incorporate some elements of genres and styles that I was interested in. But also, the last thing I'll tell you, Amy, was through my research into the music, I learned more about the music industry and the music business as it was built out, and how much the concept of genre is related to racism. You know, the classification of different types of music. You have a song sung by a black artist, and a white artist can sing that same song in homage to that artist. And the industry would say, hey, this black person's song, we're going to put that in one category. Back then, it might have been called race records. And then this other white musician will invent a new genre to keep a separation here of these groups of people. Maybe we'll call that bluegrass, or we'll call it country, or we'll call it rock and roll. You know, even though it was the same song sung the same way, they were looking at the color of the skin of the person who was singing it and enforcing that apartheid, even through the artistic business model. So I wanted to make a film that was kind of raging against the concept of genre and making the audience constantly question it, even while they were watching it, whether that's genres of music or genres of filmmaking.
This film is definitely genre-bending, genre-shattering, crosses so many genres. And again, it's about vampires. So before we go to this clip, can you set it up for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a clip with a character named Cornbread, who's played by the great Omar Benson Miller, and he was kind of hired to be the bouncer for the juke joint. And he's gone for a little bit. He goes to use the restroom, and he comes back. And since he's been gone, the character Smoke, who's one of the twins, was actually the older twin, played by Michael B. Jordan, and the character Delta Slim, played by Delroy Lindo, and the character Annie, played by Wumi Masaku. They've all had a supernatural encounter that's kind of raised their antennas to the fact that something is going on that might be greater than they can understand. And Wumi is a conjure woman who has a lot of experience, you know, with hoodoo and mysticism. And she's trying to, you know, lean on that knowledge to figure out exactly what they're dealing with. And a light bulb goes off when this character is struggling to enter the space.
Here's a clip from Sinners.
What y'all doing? Just step aside and let me on in now.
Why you need him to do that? You big and strong enough to push past us?
Well, that wouldn't be too polite now, would it, Miss Annie? I don't know why I'm talking to you anyway. Smoke.
Don't talk to him. You're talking to me right now. Why you can't just walk your big ass up in here without an invite, huh? Go ahead. Admit to it.
Admit to what?
That you dead.
So you listening to this? Now we out here playing games, telling ghost stories in place of doing what we ought to do.
Now, what is it we supposed to be doing?
Being kind to one another and being polite. Now, we is one peoples, and we shouldn't go in barging into other folks' places uninvited, so.
You've been in and out of here all day. Ain't never need an invite then. Yeah, something ain't adding up.
Can I at least get my money?
Careful.
Yep, it's scary. Sinners. We're talking to the acclaimed filmmaker, the writer of Sinners that just opened around the world. In fact, Ryan, you've just come back from London, right? I mean, I'm wondering, vampires, what it means to different cultures and what vampires mean to you?
That's a great question. I think that the vampire is one of those supernatural creatures that is kind of at the top tier of global consciousness. And I think that's because you've seen the concept of the vampire pop up in different cultures, almost independent of each other. You know, every place where you'll find human beings has a version of this creature. But it's also permeated, you know, two of the most widely spread storytelling art forms, the literature with Dracula, and all the books that have come after that, and also cinema with Dracula and its adaptations, and all the shows and films that have come, you know, after that. You know, you just got some great cinema that involves this mythical character. And for me, you know, what I think makes vampires so exciting is that they are very associated with human behavior. You know, they're associated with seduction and lust and material gain, the taboo. You know, and I think that vampires, unlike zombies and werewolves, which are the other big aliens, which, you know, the other big ones, they maintain generally a large degree of their humanity, you know, which makes them more frightening, I think, but also more alluring, and you know, so it's just rich material. And you know, one of my favorite stories I ever read is a book by Stephen King called On Writing. I remember reading this book back in 2015 when I was working on Creed, and ironically, it was the same year my uncle passed away. And I remember him talking about his process, and he had an aside about a book he wrote called Salem's Lot, and it was so interesting where he talked about being inspired to write a movie about Dracula, but have him somewhere in America, you know. And he pitched his wife Tabitha, what if I wrote a book about Dracula showing up in New York City? And she very famously said, according to the book, yeah, he would just get run over by a cab, you know, like the city was too big, it was too complicated for Dracula to even survive crossing the street. And allegedly Stephen King thought about that and took the note from his wife and then said, well, what if he arrived in a small town, you know, a sleepy American town that was kind of isolated? And then she kind of said, hey, maybe you got something there. And that became Salem's Lot. And I remember rushing off to read that book and being so moved by it. You know, and his conversation around it and on writing was that it was basically a combination of a book called Peyton's Place and Dracula. You know, and I just love the book. And I always wanted to make something that felt like it, you know. So I took that opportunity here on this movie.
And talk about what it was like for you going into the Deep South to make this film. I mean, you made the film around New Orleans, is that right? And the culture there, and your past work, and your journeys to Africa with Zinzi, your wife.
Yeah, absolutely. So, this movie was a very interesting opportunity for me to do some research about my lineage. And I had that opportunity before with the Panther films. And in that situation, you know, me being a foundational Black American, you know, my family has been here, you know, for over 400 years, essentially, you know, in North America. But you know, the Panther films allowed me to travel back to the continent of Africa and spend time there. And